The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Michelle Saracini. I'm the program assistant here in the author events office, and I'm sure that I've spoken to many of you on the phone. I hope that you are all as excited as I am today about the speaker. But first, I want to let you know to please turn off your cell phones. Pretty please. Also, unwrap any little candies you have. Make all the noise you want right now so that you don't do it in a minute. Following the presentation, Mr. Bryson will be signing books upstairs in the lobby. Now on to the good stuff. Mr. Bill Bryson is the author of 16 well-written, interesting, and very funny books on travel, language, science, and history, plus a memoir, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, for which he is appearing today. His latest book is Shakespeare, The World is Stage, which is part of the Eminent Lives series. Mr. Bryson received the Aventis and Descartes Prizes for a short history of nearly everything, holds a key to the city of Des Moines, Iowa, serves as Chancellor of Durham University in Britain. He's the President-designate of the Campaign to Protect Rural England and was made an Honorary Order of the British Empire for his contribution to literature in 2006. He also happens to be my favorite writer, so please join me in welcoming Mr. Bill Bryson.
Excuse me. Thank you very much, Michelle. Thank you for that introduction. Thank you. I'm so excited to see so many of you here today. Are you all unemployed? I didn't expect this, but anyway, thank you for turning out today. It's a delight to be back everywhere. It's a delight to be back in Philadelphia, a delight to be back at this library, which is, I was just saying to Michelle behind the scenes that this is one of the nicest and friendliest and best-run institutions. You get to know a lot of places and how well they do events when you go on book tours. And this library runs really, really nice events and always makes me feel very welcome when I come back. So I'm delighted to be here. And I'm extra especially delighted to be back in America now because when I agreed to make this trip with my publisher some many months ago, I hadn't factored in that I'd be over here at the time of the World Series, which is just wonderful because I'm a Red Sox fan. So living 8 years in New England turned me into one, and I can't help it. So, but I was really, really pleased to be here for the World Series, and of course stayed up and watched it last night. But that reminds me of a story, a true, absolutely true story that has a certain relevance both to the World Series and also to the book that I'm here to talk to you about today. And that was that 4 years ago, when the Red Sox was, before they had gone to the World Series, when they were still suffering under the curse that had been with them for so long, there was a moment at the end of the 2003 season, a wonderful moment when it looked as if the two teams that might just get into the World Series were the Boston Red Sox and the Chicago Cubs. And that, of course, would have been a hugely momentous occasion for these two teams to get in there. At that time, the Red Sox had not won a World Series since 1918, and the Cubs had not won one, and indeed still have not won one since 1908. So they had something like 170 years of collective failure between them, which is a condition I know that you can sympathize with in Philadelphia. And anyway, it just would have been a great occasion if these two kind of perennial failing teams would have got into the World Series together. And it so happens that a very good friend of mine, a guy named Keith Blackmore, is the sports editor of the London Times. And although Keith is English, he's a great baseball fan. He really understands baseball. And he called me up and said, "Look, Bill, if it is the Cubs and the Red Sox in the World Series, will you go and cover it for us? Because we think we'd need an American to explain the kind of momentous improbability of these two teams getting into the World Series at the same time." And I said, "Keith, I'd give you anything." I mean, I grew up, my father is a sports writer in Des Moines, Iowa. He went to the World Series every year for almost 40 years. It was the biggest thing in his working year. He went off in an extremely perky state every time before the World Series and came home full of stories and everything. So I grew up with this idea that the World Series was the most satisfying and exciting endeavor in which a human being could possibly be engaged. And so I had always wanted to go to a World Series, any World Series, but especially a World Series between the Red Sox and the Cubs would have been a great one to start off with. So I said, Keith, of course I'll go. Gosh, this is the nicest thing that anybody has ever offered me anywhere. I'll go for free. I'll pay my own way. Just let me go and check my diary and see if I can... And I'll confirm for you right now. So I went off and got my calendar and had a look. And I came back to the phone and made a crestfallen noise. And I said, Keith, I can't believe it. I'm so devastated. But I can't go to the World Series this year because it so happens that my daughter is getting married that week. And he was quiet for a long moment. And he said, in all seriousness, he said, look, Bill, your daughter may get married again. Anyway, I'm here today to talk to you about this book, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, or when the question and answer session comes, or anything else you want to talk about. But this is actually what has paid my way here today. And the book is just, if you don't know, the book is about growing up in the 50s. I was born in 1951, so in the middle of the century, in the middle of the country. And I think I can see enough, many of you are old enough to know that it was a really kind of a wonderful, wonderful age. One of the things that I wanted to write about was just what a terrific thing it is to be a kid. I've always been mystified by the fact that we all have childhoods that mostly are happy and fulfilling and kind of exciting and we're glad to have. And then we become adults and forget all about them. And I've never really understood why adults have so much trouble recollecting all of the events and the feelings and the experiences of childhood. Because to me, they're the most powerful experiences you have in your whole life. I mean, obviously, all the things that formed you into a fully formed human adult happened to you when you were a kid. But when you think about it, I mean, if I asked you to think about what does fresh earth smell like? What does the grass smell like? I mean, you'll be thinking about, you'll be recalling back memory that you from when you were 8 years old and lying in grass, not from yesterday. I mean, if I asked you to think about what clouds look like when they're drifting by overhead, that'll be something you probably haven't looked at since you were a kid. So when you're a kid, you have these most intensive memories, and I think very, very happy ones on the whole. And I think that's the experience for most of us. And at the time I was kicking around ideas for this book, I was struck. I went into a Borders or Barnes & Noble, one of those big barn-like stores, and I was just looking at all the memoirs, and I was struck by there were so many miserable memoirs. There were all these books about by people who had, you know, been locked in the cellar throughout their childhood or had been born a boy and raised a girl or vice versa or both or something. And I just thought, well, my childhood wasn't like that, and I don't think most people's was. My childhood was actually really quite happy. And one of the things I think about childhood is quite amazing and quite wonderful is that even for most of us, even when things are going wrong, there's often a happy outcome. And I find in adult life that hardly ever happens. When things are going badly in adult life, they just get worse. But in childhood, they actually often just turn around in the most unexpected and delightful way. And I'd like to illustrate that with a passage from the book that I think shows exactly what I'm talking about. This was an occasion in which my mother accepted an invitation on my behalf to go to Lake Aquabi for the day with the Milton family. And she expected me to be very delighted about this because Lake Aquabi was a fun place to go. It was a little lake about 20 miles south of Des Moines. It was the kind of resort for Des Moines, and it was a place that you'd normally be very excited to have a day at. But in this occasion, I was just aghast and filled with horror because the Milton family were the most obnoxious people in the city, and they were just kind of stupid, and they told dumb jokes, and they ate with their mouths open, and their favorite snack food was Fig Newtons, which I found somehow inexpressibly revolting, and they were just sort of horrible, argumentative people, and the worst part was that their son, who's Milton III. It's absolutely true. They had a tradition, if I may swear, that they always gave the oldest boy was given both the family surname as his first name. And that wasn't his real name in real life, but he'll certainly know who he is when he reads the book, because they did have this repeated name. Anyway, the son, Milton III, was just, to be with him was kind of social suicide. He was the biggest sort of nerd in the school. And the thing I remember about him was that he always pretended to be some kind of a conveyance, like a steam-driven conveyance of some kind. I never knew quite what it was, but he used to always walk through the aisles at school with his arms going like this and making chuffy noises. I mean, till he was like 14, he was doing that. And I feel sorry for him now, but I felt sorry for myself then. And anyway, so you have to imagine me at Lake Aquabi, feeling very, very sorry for myself, stuck with this dreadful family, thinking that life just can't get any worse than this. So I went to Lake Aquabi in a mood of gloomy submission, crammed into the Milton's ancient dinky Nash, a car with the comfort and stylish zip of a chest freezer, expecting the worst and receiving it. We got heatedly lost for an hour in the immediate vicinity of the state capitol building, something that was almost impossible for any normal family to do in Des Moines. And when we finally reached Aquabi, spent 90 minutes more with much additional disputation unloading the car and setting up a base camp on the shady lawn beside the beach. Mrs. Milton distributed sandwiches which were made of some kind of pink paste that looked like, and for all I know was, the stuff my grandmother used to secure her dentures to her gums. Having eaten, we had to sit quietly for 45 minutes before swimming lest we get cramps and die horribly in 6 inches of water. Mrs. Milton timed this quiet period with an egg timer and encouraged us to close our eyes and have a little sleep until it was time to swim. Far out in the lake, there was moored a large wooden platform on which stood an improbably high diving board, a kind of wooden Eiffel Tower. It was, I'm sure, the tallest wooden structure in Iowa, if not the entire Midwest. The platform was so far out from shore that hardly anyone ever visited it. Just occasionally, some teenage daredevils would swim out to have a look around. Sometimes they would even climb the many ladders to the high board and even cautiously creep out onto it. But they always retreated when they saw just how suicidally far the water was below them. No human being had ever been known to jump from the high board at Lake Aquabi. So it was quite a surprise when, as the egg timer dinged our liberation, Mr. Milton jumped up and began doing neck rolls and arm stretches and announced that he intended to have a dive off the high board. Mr. Milton had been a bit of a diving star at Lincoln High School, it must be said, but that was on a 10-foot board at an indoor pool. Aquabi was of another order of magnitude altogether. Clearly, he was out of his mind. Word of the insane intention of Mr. Milton to dive from the high board was already spreading along the beach when he jogged into the water and swam with steady, even strokes out to the distant platform. He was just a tiny stick figure when he got there, but even from such a distance, the high board seemed to loom hundreds of feet above him, indeed seemed almost to scrape the clouds. It took him at least 20 minutes to make his way up the zigzag of ladders to the top. Once at the summit, he strode up and down the long board, which was enormously long. It had to be to extend beyond the edge of the platform far below, bounced on it experimentally 2 or 3 times, then took some deep breaths, and finally assumed a position at the fixed end of the board with his arms at his sides. It was clear from his posture and poised manner that he was going to go for it. By now, all the people on the beach and in the water, several hundred altogether, had stopped whatever they were doing and were just silently watching. Mr. Milton stood for quite a long time. Then, with a nice touch of theatricality, he raised his arms, ran like hell down the long board, and imagine, if you will, an Olympic gymnast sprinting at full tilt towards a distant springboard, and you've got something of the spirit of it, took one enormous bounce and launched himself high and outward in a perfect swan dive. It was a beautiful thing to behold, I must say. He fell with flawless grace for what seemed whole minutes. Such was the beauty of the moment and the breathless silence of the watching multitudes that the only sound to be heard across the lake was the faint whistle of his body tearing through the air toward the water far, far below. It may only be my imagination, but he seemed after a time to start to glow red, like an incoming meteor. He was really moving. I don't know what happened. whether he lost his nerve or realized that he was approaching the water at a murderous velocity or what. But about three quarters of the way down, he seemed suddenly to have second thoughts about the whole business and began suddenly to flail, like someone entangled in bedding in a bad dream, or whose chute hasn't opened. When he was perhaps 30 feet above the water, he gave up on flailing and tried a new tack. He spread his arms and legs wide in the shape of an X, evidently hoping that by exposing a maximum amount of surface area, he would somehow slow his fall. It didn't work. He hit the water, impacted, really is the word for it, at over 600 miles an hour, with a report so loud that it made birds fly out of trees up to 3 miles away. At such a speed, water effectively becomes a solid. I don't believe Mr. Milton penetrated it at all, but just bounced off it about 15 feet, limbs suddenly very loose, and then just lay on top of it, still like an autumn leaf, spinning gently. He was towed to shore by two passing fishermen in a rowboat and carried to a grassy area by half a dozen onlookers who gently set him down on an old blanket. There he spent the rest of the afternoon on his back, arms and legs bent slightly and elevated. Every bit of frontal surface area on his body, from his thinning hairline to his toenails, had a raw, abraded look, as if he had suffered some unimaginable misfortune involving an industrial sander. Occasionally he accepted small sips of water, but otherwise was too traumatized to speak. Later that same afternoon, Milton Jr. cut himself with a hatchet that he had been told on no account to touch, so that he ended up bleeding, in pain, and in trouble all at the same time. It was the best day of my life. You get my point. The two big influences on my life were, as you would expect, were my parents. My father, as I said, was a sports writer for the Des Moines Register and a really, really great sports writer. I mean, he really, really was a very gifted writer. But the thing that I remember most clearly from my childhood was that he was very, very funny, and humor was something that he cultivated. And we were kind of encouraged as kids to try and follow in his train. And making people laugh at the dinner table, for instance, was considered a real coup in our house. My father, the thing he did better than anybody I've ever met was make puns. He made the best puns of anybody. I remember once we were on vacation in California, and we were driving south out of San Francisco along the San Andreas Fault, on along a road that ran parallel to the San Andreas Fault. And there was a point where he pulled over into a lookout area, and there was an information board there. We were all standing there looking out at this very visible scar that ran across the landscape in front of us. And as we were standing there admiring it, my father reached into his pocket and threw a quarter into the San Andreas Fault, because, as he explained to us, he had always wanted to be generous to a fault. And the other big influence in my life was, of course, my mother, who wasn't terribly witty or funny at all, but was and is the most wonderful, delightful human being. I've just come from Des Moines. I was there a week or so ago, and to visit her. She's 94 years old. She's living in an assisted care place now, but she's just the same as always. She's just wonderful, and she's one of these people that everybody who meets her just falls in love with her. She's a real kind of dear, sweet, saintly person who is much adored by lots and lots of people. Her only real failing as a mother was that she was the world's worst cook, and that wasn't really her fault, because first of all, this was the 50s, and all women were terrible cooks in the 50s. And really, the food was just bad in the 50s. It was just a bad time to be hungry, you know. And my mom was particularly bad because not only did she not have the materials to work with, but also everything was against her. She had a job too. She worked as a journalist on the paper in Des Moines. She was the home furnishings editor, and so she had a very full and challenging job to get through each day, as well as trying to run a home with three and raise three kids and look after my father. So you know, what I recall of my childhood was my mom going off to work, working all day at a very, you know, demanding job, coming home, rushing in the door about 5:45 in the evening, having stopped at the grocery store on the way home, throwing something in the stove, and then rushing off into some other quarter of the house to do all the 1,001 other things, jobs that had piled up during the day, the ironing and washing and all of that sort of thing. And my mom was also terribly forgetful, so she would forget that she'd put something in the oven. And we always joked in our house that you knew it was time to eat when you could hear the potatoes exploding in the oven, which was actually true. My father didn't call it the kitchen in our house. He called it the Burns unit. But my mom's specialty was that in her haste and distraction, she would often put things in the stove still in their wrapping, in the packaging. I was almost fully grown before I realized that saran wrap wasn't a kind of chewy glaze, you know. Anyway, because she had all these pressures on her, I mean, I completely forgive her about this now, but because she had all these pressures on her, my mom was often kind of vague about things, which is, I think you'll see in this passage I'm about to read to you. Incidentally, when I was in Des Moines this time, I took my mom to dinner, we were talking about this book, and she said to me, as she always says to me, she said, "I wasn't that bad a cook, you know." And I always said, no, Mom, you weren't. But in fact, she was even worse than I'd made it out in the book. Under the sink, my mother kept an enormous collection of jars, including one known in our house as the toity jar. Now, toity in our house was the term for a pea, and throughout my early years, the toity jar was called into service whenever a need to leave the house inconveniently coincided with a sudden need by someone, and when I say someone, I mean, of course, the youngest child, me, to pee. "Oh, you'll have to go in the toity jar then," my mother would say with just a hint of exasperation and a worried glance at the kitchen clock. It took me a long time to realize that the toity jar was not always, or even often, the same jar twice. Insofar as I thought about it at all, I suppose I guessed that the toity jar was routinely discarded and replaced with a fresh jar. We had hundreds, after all. So you may imagine my consternation when I went to the fridge one evening for a second helping of halved peaches and realized that we were all eating from a jar that had, only a day or two before, held my urine. I recognized the jar at once because it had a Z-shaped strip of label adhering to it that uncannily recalled the mark of Zorro, a fact that I had cheerfully remarked upon as I had filled the jar with my precious bodily nectars a day or two before, not that anyone had listened, of course. Now here it was holding our dessert peaches. "Mom," I said, coming to the dining room doorway and holding up my find, "this is the toity jar." "No, honey," she replied smoothly without looking up. "The toity jar is a special jar." "What's the toity jar?" asked my father with an amused air, spooning peach into his mouth. "It's the jar I toity in," I explained, "and this is it." "Billy toities in a jar?" said my father with very slight difficulty, as he was no longer eating the peach half he had just taken it, but resting it on his tongue pending receipt of further information concerning its recent history. "Just occasionally," my mother said, a touch uncomfortably, it has to be said. My father's mystification was now nearly total, but his mouth was so full of unswallowed peach juice that he could not meaningfully speak. He asked, I believe, why I didn't just go upstairs to the bathroom like a normal person. It was a fair question in the circumstances. "Well, sometimes we're in a hurry," my mother went on, a touch uncomfortably, "so I keep a jar under the sink, a special jar." I reappeared from the fridge, cradling more jars, as many as I could carry. "I'm pretty sure I've used all these, too," I announced. "That can't be right," my mother said, but there was a kind of question mark hanging just off the edge of it. Then she added, perhaps a touch self-destructively, "Anyway, I always rinse all jars thoroughly before reuse." My father rose and walked slowly and thoughtfully to the kitchen, inclined over the waste bin and allowed the peach half to fall into it, along with about 0.5 liter of accumulated goo. "Perhaps the toity jar is not such a good idea," he announced. So that was the end of the toity jar in our house, though it all worked out for the best, as these things so often do. After that, all my mother had to do was mention that she had something good in a jar in the fridge for dinner, and my father would get a sudden urge to take us all to Bishop's, a cafeteria downtown, which was the best possible outcome, for Bishop's was the finest restaurant that ever existed. Everything about it was divine. The food, the understated decor, the motherly waitresses in their gray uniforms who carried your tray to a table for you and gladly fetched you a new fork if you didn't like the look of the one provided. The restrooms at Bishop's had the world's only atomic toilets, at least the only ones I have ever encountered. When you flushed, the seat automatically lifted and retreated into a seat-shaped recess in the wall, where it was bathed in a purple light that thrummed in a warm, hygienic, scientifically advanced fashion, then gently came down again, impeccably sanitized, nicely warmed, and practically pulsing with atomic thermoluminescence. Goodness knows how many Iowans died from unexplained cases of buttock cancer throughout the 1950s and 60s, but it was worth every shriveled cheek. We used to take visitors from out of town to the restrooms at Bishop's to show them the atomic toilets, and they all agreed that they were the best they had ever seen. But then most things in Des Moines in the 1950s were the very best of their type. We had the smoothest, most mouth-pleasing banana cream pie at the Toddle House, and I'm told the same could be said of the cheesecake at Johnny and Kay's, though my father was much too ill at ease with quality and far too careful with his money ever to take us to that outpost of fine dining on Fleur Drive. We had the most vividly delicious neon-colored ice creams at Reed's, a parlor of cool opulence near Ashworth Swimming Pool. We had the tastiest baked goods at Barber's Bake Shop, the meatiest, most face-smearing ribs and crispiest fried chicken at a restaurant called The Country Gentleman, the best junk food at a drive-in called George the Chili King. We had our own department stores, restaurants, clothing stores, supermarkets, drug stores, florists, hardware stores, movie theaters, hamburger joints, you name it. Every one of them the very best of its kind. Well, actually, who could say if they were the best of their kind? To know that, you'd have had to visit thousands of other towns and cities all across the nation and tasted all their ice cream and chocolate pie and so on, because every place was different then. That was the glory of living in a world that was still largely free of global chains. Every community was special, and nowhere was like everywhere else. Des Moines' greatest commercial institution was Yonker Brothers, the principal department store downtown. Yonker's was enormous. It was the most elegant, up-to-the-minute, briskly efficient, satisfyingly urbane place in Iowa. It employed 1,200 people. It had the state's first escalators and first air conditioning. Everything about it, its silkily swift revolving doors, its gliding stairs, its whispering elevators, each with its own white-gloved operator, seemed designed to pull you in and keep you happily, contentedly consuming. Yonkers was so vast and wonderfully rambling that you seldom met anyone who really knew it all. Its sanctum sanctorum was the tea room, a place where doting mothers took their daughters for a touch of elegance while shopping. Nothing about the tea room remotely interested me until I learned of a ritual that my sister mentioned one day in passing. It appeared that young visitors to the tea room were invited to reach into a wooden box containing small gifts, and each beautifully wrapped in white tissue and tied with ribbon, and select one to take away as a permanent memento of the occasion. Once my sister passed on to me a present she had acquired and didn't much care for, a die-cast coach and horses. It was only tiny, about 2.5 inches long, but exquisite in its detailing. The doors really opened, the wheels turned, a tiny driver held thin metal reins. The whole thing had obviously been hand-painted by some devoted, underpaid person from the defeated side of the Pacific Ocean. I had never seen, much less owned, such a fine thing before. From time to time after that, for years, I besought them to take me with them when they went to the tea room, but they always responded vaguely that they didn't like the tea room so much these days, or that they had too much shopping to do to stop for lunch. But finally, there came a day when I was perhaps 8 or 9 years old that I was shopping downtown with my mom, with my sister not there, and my mother said to me, "Shall we go to the tea room?" Well, I don't believe I have ever in my whole life been so eager to accept an invitation. We ascended in an elevator to a floor I didn't even know Yonkers had. The tea room was the most elegant place I had ever been, like a stateroom from Buckingham Palace magically wafted to the Middle West of America. Everything about it was starched and classy and calm. There was light music of a refined nature and the tink of cutlery on china and of ice water carefully poured. I cared nothing for the food, of course. I was waiting only for the moment when I was invited to step up to the toy box and make my selection. When that moment came, it took me forever to decide. Every little package looked so perfect and white, so ready to be enjoyed. Eventually, after much agonizing, I chose an item of middling size and weight, which I dared to shake lightly. Something inside rattled and sounded as if it might be diecast. I took it to my seat and slowly and carefully unwrapped it. It was a miniature doll. An Indian baby in a papoose, beautifully made but patently for a girl. I returned with it and its disturbed packaging to the slightly backward-looking fellow who was in charge of the toy box. "I seem to have got a doll," I said, with something approaching an ironic chuckle. He looked at it carefully. "Well, that's surely a shame, because you only get one try at the gift box." "Yes, but it's a doll," I repeated, "for a girl." "Well, then you'll just have to get your little girlfriend to give it to, won't you?" he answered, and gave me a toothy grin and an unfortunate wink. Sadly, those were the last words the poor man ever spoke. A moment later, he was just a small muffled shriek and a smoldering spot on the carpet. Too late, he had learned an important lesson. You really should never fuck with a Thunderbolt Kid. Thank you. Well, I was going to stop there, but just the other day I came across one paragraph that I want to read you. It's an absolutely true paragraph from a newspaper in the 50s. What happened was when I decided to do this book, I went back to Des Moines and I locked myself away in the Drake University Library for about 2 weeks, and I just read old copies of the Des Moines Register and Des Moines Tribune, the old morning and evening newspaper, on microfilm. Just kind of randomly, just taking out spools from the 50s and early 60s and just reading them. And it was tremendously productive in terms of generating memories and material for the book, because it was very helpful, I found, just to look at TV listings or to look at what was on at the movies at particular times. And I would often see a movie that I had seen, and by realizing that it was in the third week of January 1959 or something, that would start to trigger other memories. So it was a really, really interesting exercise. But one of the unexpected parts of that exercise was that I kept finding these little filler stories everywhere that often were, and I dare say still are in many papers, the most interesting and kind of unpredictable and exciting part of the whole paper. And having worked as a copy editor on newspapers for many years, I understand a lottery it is whether a filler story gets in the paper or not, because they're only in there because they just happen to fill a hole. The real story didn't quite reach the bottom of the page, and somebody in the composing room had to reach around and look for a story that was, 17 lines deep or 16 or 14 or whatever was the necessary length. They edit, every day, what they used to when I was working in Hot Metal, they used to edit 30 or 40 of these stories, send them down, and they were just there, and three or four of them would get used in the paper, and the rest would get swept away. So there was a kind of lottery of quality to these things. And often, as I say, they were the most delightful things in the paper, and I started saving them just because they amused me without any idea of what I was going to do with them. And very late in the process of putting the book together, it occurred to me, well, maybe some of these could go as just starters to each chapter, just put them at the start of each chapter, as a way of just kind of trying to capture the essence of that decade, that period. And so I put them in. I tried to choose ones that were as faithful to the theme of each chapter as I could, but mostly they're just there because they either amuse me or because they seem to somehow add a little bit of flavoring to the period. And there was one I'd completely forgotten about. I just came across it the other day when I was looking through the book for something else, and it amused me, and I hope it'll amuse you too, and I'd just like to read it to you. It's a one-paragraph a story from the Associated Press. It ran in the Des Moines Register on September the 20th, 1957. It's datelined East Hampton, Connecticut, and it says in full, "A search of Lake Pocatopog for a reported drowning victim was called off here Tuesday when it was realized that one of the volunteers helping the search, Robert Houseman, 23, of East Hampton, was the person being sought." It was just that kind of a decade, And on that note, I'm very happy to throw the floor open to questions if anyone has any. I'm told there's a very strict regime we have to follow here. We've got Michelle and another delightful-looking lady here. They both have microphones, which they can use as cudgels if you don't behave. And you're to wait until I'm calling you, and then they will rush to you with the microphone. And if you speak your question clearly into it. There's a lady just here. Try.
Mr. Bryson.
Oh, hello. I'm Norma Milner. This is a very familiar place to me, but I haven't been here for a while. I first read you in Australia, and I have to ask you, did you write two books about Australia? The one I read was given to me by my hostess. It was either in 1990 or 2000. I don't know which. You see, I'm getting kind of ancient. Anyway, in the book I read, you wrote about a sea plant that was above Perth on the coast, and you realized it was one of the earliest plants on the globe. Do you recall that at all?
I don't.
It was kind of a bubbling thing in the water that you wrote about.
Oh, stromatolite.
Yes,
I'm happy to talk about that.
Which book was? Did you write two books?
No, I didn't write two books. There is an explanation. I wrote one book, but it came out with two different titles. One title in Britain and the Commonwealth, and one title in United States and North America. And the reason for that was that right up to the very last minute, the book was going to be called No Worries, which is, of course, the Australian national catchphrase. And then they discovered, just as the book was about to go into print, that there was already a book in print with that title. And so we hurriedly had to come up with alternatives. And I sent off alternate lists of alternative titles to publishers in London and New York. And they couldn't agree between them on what was the right title for the book. And so in this sort of situation of some desperation, they both selected different titles, which they have a right to do. I mean, you have to understand that they have to choose the title that they think is the most appealing to their own particular market. So in Britain, it was published as Down Under, and in America, it was published as... Yes, In a Sunburned Country. I forget my own books. That's how old I'm getting. You think you've got problems, recall. But In a Sunburned Country. And the books are completely identical in almost every respect. There's, I mean, a few tiny tweakings where I might explain a little more about who a cricket player was to an American audience that wouldn't need to a British audience, and that kind of thing. But the books are essentially identical. But this came out in different countries with different markets with different titles. And I found, to my astonishment, that lots of people, I mean, quite a number of people, would buy the book in their own country and then fly somewhere else and say, oh, look, Bill Bryson's got another book out on Australia. And buy the second one and realize they'd bought the same book again and then write a filthy letter to me accusing me of running this very elaborate scam, which they were taking very personally. And so that actually happens. And I had the same thing happen with another book for different reasons. I did a book that in Britain was called Notes from a Big Country, which was just a collection of articles I'd written for a newspaper in Britain. And then when it was published here, they didn't like that title and insisted I come up with a different title. And I gave it as an alternative title here was I'm a Stranger Here Myself. And that's essentially the same book in the two countries. And again, I've had lots of letters, and I do apologize to anybody. But thank you if you did buy the book twice. Now, in terms of what you were talking about, on Western Australia, there is this, if you go 800 miles up the coast of Western Australia, there is this place called Shark Bay, which just seems like the loneliest place in the world. I mean, it's very, very remote. Sensationally beautiful oceanfront, nobody around. I mean, for 800 miles, there's nobody around. And growing there are these tiny, a very primitive kind of organism, cyanobacteria, forming something called stromatolites. And if you want to know more, and I'm sure most of you don't, you have to read the book. But what Shark Bay does is it gives you this environment that is really, really quite evocative of what Earth was like in its formative days. It's the one place where this is what the whole of the planet was once like. The Earth was just covered with these little stromatolites. And they are the organisms that actually created the oxygenated atmosphere that we are so glad to breathe now. So just by puffing out little bits of, it was all part of their respiration process. So it is kind of an amazing place. You go to this place and they're not much to look at. It's a long way to go. You feel slightly silly for having driven 800 miles. But at the same time, you stand there on this beach and you can see these things growing just under the water. They form sort of pillow-shaped. Well, they look exactly like very, very large cowpats. They really do. And growing underwater, and it's kind of crazy to have gone that far to see them, but at the same time, it's the only place on Earth you can stand on a beach and look at them, and it's just kind of amazing to think that you're seeing something that has just survived from a very primeval part of Earth's history. Australia is full of places like that. I've never been anywhere that's felt older. You know, I mean, it's this new country on an immensely old continent. Wherever you go, the earth beneath your feet just always feels absolutely ancient. It's a kind of an inescapable feeling everywhere you go. Quite wonderful. Thank you. Somebody over here, gentleman with his hand up.
Could you tell me your literary influences? Who do you like to read?
Who do I like to read? The ones that influenced me were a lot. I mean, a lot of writers that I don't think I would be quite so enamored with now. I mean, when I was a young teenager, for instance, I went through a long phase of was crazy about J.D. Salinger. I haven't read anything by him for probably 30 years, and I don't know quite how I would take it now. But the thing I liked about Salinger is the same thing I like about a lot of other writers that I read for pleasure or with admiration, Ian McEwan, John Updike, Nicholson Baker, people like that. It's just how well they express themselves, how well they can take, just form sentences. Because I do it myself all the time. I'm full of admiration for people who can just, they need to communicate a piece of information and they do it in a way that just makes you sit up and take notice and think it's just words, but it's so great the way they do it. And the other person that's become kind of belatedly influential to me because I've just finished doing a biography of him was William Shakespeare. It's just come out, and it's a concise biography for a series of concise biographies of great people. And I ended up writing the William Shakespeare for this series. And of course, like most people, I had a real appreciation and admiration for William Shakespeare. But having been immersed in his stuff for a couple of years, I just, staggered by what he could do, that 400 and some years later, he can still make you laugh. He can still make you, leave you moved. You can still be on the edge of your seat with excitement by the things he wrote. I just, I find that unbelievably powerful that somebody could do something that could live that long, that could be timeless. I think that's, so Shakespeare, I think, takes some beating. Someone here, gentleman in the end?
Yes. Beside going through archives, what other techniques do you use to come up with all of this material about memoirs?
A lot of it I just make up. No. I'm just teasing it. But it is funny, I had an experience with my good friend Stephen Katz, the guy I went hiking in. He's doing great. I just come from Des Moines, as I said. I saw my mom and I saw him. In fact, we all went out to dinner together. Katz is doing great. He went back to Des Moines after our walk in the woods, after our hike on the Appalachian Trail. He settled down. He's got a job, a good steady job working at a satellite printing plant for the Wall Street Journal. So he's got good job with good pay. He is completely clean. Hasn't had a drink for years. He's really sorted himself out, and he got married last year, and to a really, really delightful woman. And so he's very, very happy, and looked better than he's looked in years, and is really settled down. But Katz was this guy I went hiking on the Appalachian Trail with, and when I wrote the book, A Walk in the Woods, I was very nervous about how he was going to take it, because if you've read the book, you know that I treat him as this kind of comical buffoon because he is. But I'm also hugely indebted to him because, more to him than any other person on earth except my wife. Because he stuck with me on the Appalachian Trail. It was really hard and it never stopped being hard. And sometimes it was just the most wretched circumstance in which I've ever found myself. You're cold and wet and sore and hungry and just lots and lots of miserable conditions all at once. And I had to be there. I mean, I had a book contract in my back pocket. I had told the world I was going to do this thing. I had a commitment to do it. He didn't have to, but he could easily have left me at any time. Just said, Bryson, look, I'm really sorry. You know, I gave this my best shot, but I just can't stand it. And I wouldn't have been able to blame him at all. I would have let him go quite happily. But he didn't do that. He stood by me the whole time. And then when I came to write the book, I turned him into this kind of grotesque comic figure. Because there just wasn't any getting away from it. And I was really nervous about how he would respond to the book. And I sent it to him just after I sent it to him in manuscript form. I printed out an extra copy, sent it to him, and then waited to hear from him. Because we still talk on the phone every couple of weeks. And sure enough, after a couple of weeks, he calls me up on a Sunday morning, and he starts talking in a totally amiable way, but about other things altogether. And I said, wait a minute, you know, I've been dying here to know what you think of the book. And he said, oh, that. He said, yeah, it's pretty funny. And I said, well, that doesn't sound like a complete answer, really. You know, that's you're holding back, aren't you? And he said, well, it's all fiction, isn't it? I swear to God, I was absolutely flabbergasted. I said, if anybody on the planet knows that this is a nonfiction work, you were right there with me. I mean, I don't understand what you think is fictitious about it. I said, do you deny that you threw all that food out of your pack on the very first night as we walked up the first hill? And he said, well, no, that's true. And I said, do you deny that I had to put your tent up for you on the first night because you were being such a big baby? And he said, well, no, that's true, too. And we kind of went through the whole book until I had established, certainly to my satisfaction, that these were all true stories, you know? And I said, so where's the fiction? And he said, well, it's just the way you tell it. So I think there is that. I mean, there is a kind of a larger answer to your question there, which is that all of these things in all of my books, they do actually happen. I mean, Mr. Milton did really do the world's most spectacular and memorable and, it has to be said, satisfying belly flop off the high board at Equality. He didn't hit the water at 600 miles an hour, but you know, most of that story is true. And what I do is I just take these little stories, these things that actually happened, and then just expand on them and give them a dusting of hyperbole and so on. And then that's what eventually you end up with a book. Shall we try somebody? I don't mean to make you spent, but there's somebody back towards the back. I don't want to ignore the people at the back. There's a hand up right in the middle of sort of three rows, four rows up in the back, waving towards, standing up. That's the man. I think this guy really wants to ask a question.
I've been dying to ask you this question. Now, in reading a brief history of nearly everything, I noticed, although I don't think you ever were explicit about it, I noticed that there was a parallel between your comments on the Big Bang Theory and the Genesis creation story. And I just wanted to ask, was I accurate in maybe reading that you think there is some parallel description or accuracy to that, or am I just... off the wall.
No, I mean, what I found in writing the book is that I had no axe to grind, no agenda at all, absolutely none. I was simply trying to take an empty mind and fill it with as much scientific understanding as I could. So I wasn't trying to push a kind of system of beliefs or anything like that. I absolutely wasn't. And I've never been. If you don't know what the book is about, it was really me trying to understand the universe and how it got the way it is. My starting point was the Big Bang 13 and a half billion years ago and then us being here now. How did that happen? How did we get from that moment to this? So really, it was just trying to understand the whole of science and how scientists worked all these things out. Because I've always been fascinated by how anybody could figure out how much the Earth weighs or how far it is to Jupiter or how fast light travels. All of that kind of, how do they, you know, it's not just what we know, but how do we know what we know? And that was all I was trying to do. In the course of doing the book, I kept running into certain spiritual elements to it, which did not affect me personally, frankly. I mean, I'm not a spiritual person. I'm not much drawn in that direction. But what I did realize as I was reading the book is that there's nothing incompatible between orthodox scientific belief and devout spirituality. Because every question you ask in science, always, at some point, will go back to a place where where God is as good an answer as any. I mean, if you just say, why did the Big Bang happen when it did? No scientist can really tell you why it happened at that instant, and not, you know, 10 billion years earlier or 2 minutes earlier. So God is as good an answer. Or, you know, just those kind of answers, all the imponderables in life in the universe, if you're prepared to look at a giant scale, you know, God can explain these things very comfortably if that's the direction you want to go in. And I was amazed that, in realizing that, I was amazed that so many people who have really very conservative, fundamentalist, creationist religious beliefs, I can't understand why they don't go with that, because it seems to me that that explanation makes the universe far more wondrous than a sort of literal interpretation of the Bible universe, where God just did it all in 7 days and then just listened to Republicans for the rest of the time. I just think, you know, this large, long-scale, vast universe, the idea that he created, if indeed he did, but, you know, there was this spark of existence 13 and a half billion years ago. That, to me, as I say, is not remotely incompatible with spiritual belief or with, you know, fundamental orthodox scientific beliefs. I don't know if that's answered your question at all. Someone over here, somebody with a blue cardigan on, I think. Oh, okay.
A couple quick questions. I was wondering, I was looking at the Shakespeare book at Borders, and I saw that you're living in England, and I had thought that you were living here, and I was just wondering when you moved back. And then the other question is, I remember reading that they were making Walk in the Woods into a movie, and I was wondering, is that still happening, and do you have anything to do with that?
Oh, yeah, well, I could answer both those questions. We moved back to England in 2003. We lived in New Hampshire from 1995 to 2003. The move back and forth, it was nothing to do with any kind of dissatisfaction in either direction at any time. I had lived in England for 20 years, very, very happy there. In 1995, we decided slightly impetuously, let's go live in America for 4 or 5 years. I'd always felt very, very lucky to have had a chance to live in two different countries and experience two cultures. And my wife and I just thought, well, it would be a great thing to give the kids, to let them spend part of their childhoods in America. They are half American after all. And so we decided to come back, and we ended up staying not for 4 or 5 years, but for 8 years, partly because we were so happy and having a good time, partly because I've got 4 kids, and they got embedded in the education system, and it's not really very easy at certain levels to move the kids back and forth between the two systems. But in 2003, there was a moment came where we kind of thought, well, either we've got to stay on for the youngest to go all the way through middle school and high school, or go back now. And so we went back, and I'm very glad to be back. It's not really such a wrenching thing. The Atlantic has become really quite a small body of water. You can come back and forth all the time. I like living in England. We went back, and we always intended to go back at some point. So we did. That was the answer to that. And what was the other point? Oh, the Walk in the Woods is a movie. Well, the Walk in the Woods, I mean, Robert Redford and his company have had an option on Walk in the Woods as a film for a couple of years now, at least, perhaps a bit longer. And I did actually meet him in London a year or so ago, and he was at that time still very keen to make it into a movie. It was going to be with him and Paul Newman. And they were clearly going to have to change the characters in some way, and make them both older rather than, you know, this was going to have to be which I thought would have worked really, really well. And I guess they came very, very close to, you know, getting it all signed up for a deal. And I gather Paul Newman decided he's just too old. I think he's 82 now, and he just didn't want to make a movie that was going to be so physically taxing as that would be. There would have to be quite a lot of being out in the open, and so he pulled out. And the last I heard, Robert Redford was trying to persuade some other big name to join him on the Appalachian Trail. Whether something comes of it or not, I don't know. They don't keep in daily contact with me. I don't know. So, but Robert Redford's a very nice man. I can say that. He's a very nice man. Very charismatic. He's a really smart guy. I try another big waving hand back here. Hold on, we'll give you the microphone and then everybody can hear your question.
I just had a question and a comment, and you answered that question. So my comment is I just wanted to say thank you. You indirectly or directly, however you want to, changed my life. Someone sent me the book on tape, A Walk in the Woods, because I'd always talked about hiking the AT. And because of that book, I went out and did it. And it was the best. Hey, no applause necessary.
How long did it take you?
Well, I took 10 months. I had planned to take 8. Usually people do it in 6, but I knew I'm a hiker just by nature. And I was planning on taking 8, and I got out there, and I was having so much fun that I just kept going slower and slower and slower. Got to hike every side trail. But the best thing about it was it changed my life. It changed every aspect of my life, and I'm a much happier person because of it. I've learned to accept some things I can't change. In fact, if you hadn't been here today, I would have woken up on the AT this morning, because each year on my birthday, I go back and wake up.
Oh, so it's your birthday. Happy birthday.
It's my birthday time. But because, again, no applause necessary. But because you were here, I decided to change that for this year, come in and just say, thanks for that book, because... as great, I know a lot of people here probably read that book, as great as you made it seem, it's 1,000 times better. Just the whole experience. Even the bad stuff that happens, and obviously, for obvious reasons, my hike was different than yours. But even the horrible stuff that happens out there, I've coined the phrase, it's amazing what you can walk away from. And I appreciate
that. That's fantastic. Thank you. Thanks. See, what an audience. I mean, usually I just get asked, do I use a pen or a word processor? Anyway, happy birthday. I'm glad you had a wonderful time. It's time for two more questions, I'm told. So, look, just there beside you, behind you.
Hi there, Bill. Welcome back to the States. When you come back into the country, is there anything you can't wait to get or that you like so much that's just so, that's so ghastly American that I can't wait to be around it, or anything you miss when you're over there?
Oh, Bill O'Reilly, because I think I don't have to watch this anymore. Really, it's just fairly obvious things. I mean, baseball, really, really. I watch anybody play baseball, but I do love that. And if I'm here during the season, if there are games on, other sports in a kind of descending order of importance, and then just classic American food, cheeseburgers and things like that. And there's certain restaurants in Des Moines when I go home that I'm eager to go back to. And tragically, they are dying off one by one. A lot of the foods that I grew up with are no longer exist. A lot of those things I was talking about in the book, as having been really special to me, are no longer there. But there's still a few left, so I go back and eat those things. And, of course, seeing friends and family. One more offer. Choose somebody. Anyone you like.
First, I love the ending of A Walk in the Woods, and I thought that was really a class act. What I want to ask you is, first, if you can recall how you felt about that when you left and didn't complete it, and also, what's it like when you're walking the trail and at the same time you know you're going to write a book about it? How is that different from him walking the trail?
It's very different, because the whole time we were walking the trail, I thought, I'm never going to get a book out of this. I mean, we might as well quit now. I really don't know what we're doing out here. We keep sticking with it. Another week's gone by, and there's still nothing happening. We're not getting any material. I felt that every step of the way until we got to the very end, and Katz disappeared in Maine. And I thought, thank Christ, if he lives, this will really help the book. But the rest of the time, all the time we're walking along, every day I was taking notes. And all I was writing in my notebook at the end of the day was, spent day walking. And I'm sure the gentleman here will agree with me that there's a kind of, you go into a kind of zen state with it, that you're doing the same thing over and over all day long. You're just putting one foot in front of another. And that can actually become quite wonderful. And you really do, it is a cleansing exercise. You feel, you feel immensely healthy from it all. But it doesn't produce material. There's not, and I really thought the whole time, I'm never going to get a book out of this. And it wasn't really until we finished the trip and sat down that I I started thinking, well, actually, you know, there were these things, there were these people we met along the way, things happened here and there. There was a blizzard here and, you know, Mary Ellen there and things like that. There were just, you know, and so I managed to squeeze a book out of it. But I can absolutely tell you that there isn't one single bit of overmatter left over. There's nothing. Anything that was remotely relevant to the trip and the experience we had is in the book. So it was really kind of a close-run thing. And on that note, I think before everybody leaves one by one, I better say thank you all very, very much and have a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks again to Bill Bryson, and we'll be having a book signing upstairs momentarily.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.